Why do people do what they do, say what they say, and think like they think? My guest today is going to get inside our heads and tell us why. According to his bio, longtime Knox College professor of psychology, Frank McAndrew, is well known as a purveyor of psychological science to lay audiences. His blog at Psychological Today magazine and his other op-ed articles have attracted over 25 million readers, and many of his essays have been featured in textbooks and online teaching resources. Frank is a frequent guest on TV and radio news talk programs, and his research has been profiled in media outlets such as Time, The New Yorker, PBS NewsHour, NPR, Fox News, CNN, The Atlantic, Wall Street Journal, New York Times. It goes on and on. His work has even been lampooned by comedians like Jay Leno and Conan O'Brien. But we're lucky to have Frank with us today here in the WGL studios. Frank, thank you for joining me on Galesburg Live.
Thank you for having me, Jay.
Yeah, we've been wanting to have you back. This is kind of a topical, kind of seasonal for this topic. So we're going to talk about quite a few things today. But so there's a lot of things I want to know as far as why people do what they do, think, and say. But, you know, like I said, since it's kind of the spookiest time of the year, let's start with a little creepy talk. And tell us about the relationship between creepiness, horror, and fear.
Sure. Well, creepiness, horror, and fear are three words that we often use interchangeably. People will talk about something creeping them out or horror. They think of it as the same thing. But they're really three distinctly different emotional experiences. And a good horror movie puts all of them together.
Okay.
So creepiness is all about uncertainty. You're not sure if there's something to worry about. You're not sure if there's a dangerous character lurking in the dark, but you're kind of uncomfortable because there might be. So It's all about uncertainty. Horror is what happens when it dawns on you that there is a problem, there is danger, but you may not yet quite know what it is or what it is you're supposed to do to deal with it. And fear is the last stage where, aha, I know what the problem is.
It's time to do something.
And I know exactly what I need to be doing to try to get out of here. So a good horror movie starts off with the characters getting kind of creeped out. They're camping in the woods, or they're walking through an old house, or they're interacting with a stranger that's a little bit off. And they're kind of wallowing in discomfort, but they aren't really sure there's anything to worry about.
So they're not quite in the danger zone yet. I mean, there's just something about them that people kind of recognize.
Yeah, their radar is on, and they're hyper-vigilant, making sure that there's nothing here to worry about. But then eventually it crosses that line to, oh my God, this is there's something really wrong here. But you now know you're in danger, but you may not quite understand exactly the nature of the threat. You're kind of paralyzed because you don't really know what it is you're supposed to do. And then finally, when you figure out exactly what the threat is, it's fear, and you know exactly what action you need to take to try to deal with it. Some movies cut right to the chase, like the chainsaw movies, where right from the get-go, the guy is chasing you around with the chainsaw, and you go right to the fear thing, and there's not a whole lot of creeping and horror going on before that.
We kind of were talking before we went on air about Psycho. I don't know if that's necessarily a horror movie, but I mean, where does just that movie specifically, where does that kind of fit in?
I think that works for exactly the same reason. You start off with Anthony Perkins being this desk clerk at this hotel, and he's just odd. Yeah. You know, the woman is checking in, and his conversation is awkward, and his nonverbal behaviors are kind of off, and he's just really quirky. And this puts us on our guard, because if the guy doesn't understand these basic rules of social interaction, what other rules doesn't he understand, and where might he go with that? But on the other hand, he could just be this nice, awkward guy and just scream and run away from him and be kind of rude. So you're left just kind of uncomfortable. But then eventually, you know, when he shows up at the shower with the knife.
That's kind of a sign.
He's moved out of the creepy zone into the fear zone.
And before we go on, I guess creepy, you know, especially nowadays, you hear the word creepy a lot. That doesn't necessarily have to go into danger or fear, but there's just a creepy factor also about some people that it seems like a popular word these days.
Well, that's kind of got what got me started on this whole line of research. I started noticing how often I would hear people say, boy, that guy really creeped me out, or that's a creepy place. And I got curious about, well, what exactly do you mean by that? And I would start asking questions. Is it the same thing as fear? Is it the same thing as disgust? And people were having trouble putting it into words, but no, it's something different than those other things. And so I started doing some experiments and seeing how people respond to creepy stimuli and what it's all about. And but yeah, well, we get creeped out on a regular basis when you think about it.
Is that somewhat of a... I know the word creepy's always been around, but I mean, is that kind of a generational, like a younger person thing or not?
Well, I think the term might have been different in the past, yeah. But people have always been aware that, you know, you get the willies. There's all these different expressions mm-hmm. that have come and gone about being uncomfortable
right.
because you're uncertain about what's going on.
Okay. I'm talking today to longtime Knox College professor of psychology, Frank McAndrew. So like I've mentioned, personally, I'm not a fan of haunted houses, horror movies. You know, I mentioned to you, I was scared of the Wicked Witch of the West in
me too.
back in the Wizard of Oz days. But what does it say about people like me that don't like this kind of genre or, you know,
I don't think it says anything profoundly bad about you or people that don't like that. I think people get a lot of different rewards from watching horror movies, and one of them is that adrenaline rush. Mm-hmm. You know, your heart starts pounding and adrenaline's getting into the system. And people are different from each other according to how much they enjoy that. There are thrill seekers who enjoy bungee jumping and all kinds of things that get the heart racing. And horror movies are kind of like that. And if you're a person who doesn't enjoy the adrenaline rush so much, you're not going to enjoy horror movies either. But it isn't really about the horror as much as you just, you know, aren't in it for the arousal.
Yeah.
But it can also mean you've got a particular squeamishness about supernatural things or, you know, things that aren't normal.
Right.
And so you're going to avoid them more than most people.
Yeah. How about you personally? Are you into them?
I like them. I will not say that I'm obsessed with them the way some people are, but I don't get to see as many horror movies as I would like because my wife is not into them. And she usually has the final say on what movies we go to see. One of our first dates way back when was The Exorcist. And I don't think we've ever got past that.
Oh, man, that's just something, I don't know, you know, I'm not sure what scene it is. I haven't watched it, but even the commercials just kind of, you know, I kind of have to turn away when I watch
it. Well, that combines the whole thing. You've got the creepiness of the child who's supposed to be innocent and unthreatening, mm-hmm. but isn't. And you've got the devil, and you've got all kinds of layers of scary, creepy things put together in one movie.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't just one guy with a chainsaw.
Yeah. Kind of sticking on the, you know, the Halloween kind of theme. Why are some people more likely to see ghosts than others?
Well, the ability to see ghosts or the interest in seeing ghosts, I guess, is it's like a personality difference. There's an old saying that the first requirement for seeing a ghost is believing that there's a ghost mm-hmm. in the house. So when there is an ambiguous thing in our environment, there's a cold spot that we walk through where there's a strange sound coming from upstairs. If you don't believe in ghosts or ever think about them, right away your first reaction is, gee, we must have a heating problem uh-huh. or maybe there's some curtains flapping in the breeze up there. But if you believe that you've got a ghost in the house right away, uh-oh, there it is. Or if maybe you find something has been moved in your house. Well, probably you moved it yourself and just weren't paying attention, forgot about it. But now there's a more sinister explanation for that. And so there's a tendency, once you believe that they're real, to see them more frequently than somebody who doesn't. But there are also some personality differences that psychologists have discovered. There are different ways of sort of making decisions about what's true and what isn't. And it isn't that one is good and one is bad. Intelligent people use both of them. But one of them is sort of an intuitive thing. You go with your gut. You trust your instincts. The other approach is much more analytical and cautious. You try not to jump to conclusions because you don't trust your intuition. Mm-hmm. And you try to gather information before making decisions. And people who are more intuitive are more likely, it seems, to endorse paranormal beliefs of all kinds, including ghosts. And also, there's a personality trait known as tolerance for ambiguity. how crazy does it drive you if you don't know for sure what's going to happen, or you don't like uncertainty? The more like that you are, the more likely you are.
Is it kind of all or nothing with ghosts? I mean, do you either just, oh, I believe in them, I totally believe in them, or I just, no way? Or is there like some happy medium?
Oh, no, I think it's a gradient. At the one end, you've got people who absolutely deny that it's possible. And at the other end, you've got true believers. And then you've got everybody kind of falling in between. It ties up with a lot of interesting things, too. I mean, your religious background plays a role in it. Most religions have, as part of their story, supernatural things, right? There are angels and demons and spirits and all kinds of things. So once you've opened the door to those things being real, it's not much of a jump to say, well, these other things can be real as well. And there was one interesting study that showed that devoutly religious people and unbelievers are less likely to believe in ghosts than those people in the middle who are sort of religious but don't buy in completely. But I think the real role of religion is not so much whether you believe in ghosts or not, but if you do encounter one, who it is you think you're meeting.
How about you personally? Are you, I'm going to keep digging in on your personal side here, but are you a believer in ghosts or?
Well, I remember somebody asking Stephen King at a lecture that I went to many, many years ago, whether he believed in ghosts and these sort of things. And his answer was no, but late at night when I'm home alone, yes, always. So I might put myself in that category, I suppose.
Yeah. You kind of talked about who does and who doesn't. I mean, is there anything, you know, gender-wise, is there anything that kind of like certain markers that as far as ghosts?
Well, women are more likely than men to endorse paranormal beliefs in general.
Okay.
Whether we're talking about, you know, clairvoyance and ESP and all that, and that would include ghosts. Mm-hmm. With one exception, men are more likely than women to believe in aliens and the Loch Ness Monster and Bigfoot, you know, these kinds of creatures that might be out there. And that's something that's been documented in surveys over and over.
Yeah.
So that's the main difference, I think.
So how about the horror movies? We kind of talked about those, but like, what different kind of horror movies are there?
Well, I think you've got the slasher films where the emphasis is on, you know, people being chopped up and mutilated. But then you also have these suspenseful ones where not a whole lot happens during the film. One of my favorites is a very old classic, The Haunting of Hill House. And then there was a remake just called The Haunting, where these people are trapped in this house. And throughout the whole film, it always seems like something is about to happen and you're always on edge. But not much actually happens. One of my favorites is The Shining, where, you know, this family is isolated up in the mountains in the middle of winter. And that's one of the classic themes in horror movies. You're in a place where it's going to be hard to escape if something bad happens, and it's going to be hard for anybody to get there to help you. And the telephones always stop working. Did you ever notice that?
Yeah.
Whenever there's suddenly you can't call anybody, there's a storm or the wires have been cut. So that's, I tend to be more of a fan of the ones that slowly, they let your imagination do the work.
Okay. And some of them are obviously Halloween themed, but horror movies, I guess, can be popular or are watched any time of the year.
Sure, sure. And I think there's, it at first was a very peculiar thing to me to wonder why we spend money to do this. Mm-hmm. We spend a lot of money on horror movies and haunted houses. And things that we know are going to scare us, and we spend hours watching characters that we would avoid like the plague in day-to-day real life. And that seems like a very perverse thing, but I think it taps into part of human nature that's been with us forever. We like stories, and we like stories about people because our prehistoric ancestors didn't have the luxury of learning a lot of important things through trial and error. Mm-hmm. What happens to you if you fall off a cliff or try to pet a lion? I mean, you've got to know this stuff without trying it yourself. And so our history is full of stories like Hansel and Gretel about what happens to the kids who disobey their parents and walk off into the woods alone. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of programmed to pay attention to what happens to people who do things that we shouldn't do. And so when you go to a horror movie, it's almost a chance to mentally rehearse strategies for what you might do
right.
if you were ever in that situation. Right. Seeing the mistakes somebody makes when they're trying to get away from the serial killer. You can even hear people in the audience saying things like, no, no, don't go in there. You're living it with them. And so we go to these movies because we're learning something valuable. Now, I'm not suggesting this is conscious. Mm-hmm. You know, that before I go to the movies, I sit down and say, well, I'm really going to learn something about how to avoid serial killers or yeah, shark attacks.
Take notes or something.
Yeah, yeah. No. But our impulse to be drawn to these things comes from this place where it's been adaptive for us to do this.
Okay. I'm talking today to longtime Knox College professor of psychology, Frank McAndrew. So tell us a little bit, you know, your background. How did you end up being a professor of psychology at Knox?
Well, I mean, it's not a very exciting story. Way back when I was finishing up graduate school at the University of Maine, I decided I wanted to try this job as a professor and see how that worked out. And at that time in particular, it was really difficult to get a tenure track faculty position at a college or university. Mm-hmm. And so when you were finishing up your PhD, you basically applied for every job in North America that you were remotely qualified for, as well as a bunch that you really weren't remotely qualified mm-hmm. for, but you applied anyway. And when you got that first offer, you hung on to it like grim death. And Knox was the first solid offer that I got. And so I took the position here. And when we arrived, we thought, well, we'll probably stay here a couple of years and then move on. We were both back from the East Coast and far away from family and so forth. But yeah, it just sort of grew on us. I always liked the job, and Galesburg, you know, became home.
How about the field of psychology? How did you get into that? I mean, what drew you into that field?
Good question, because I think in many ways I'm different than a lot of psychologists, and I'm certainly different than most of the students I have at Knox who mm-hmm. think they want to be psychology majors. A lot of people are drawn to the field because they want to help others, and they're interested in becoming therapists. And I was never interested in that stuff at all. When I started college, I had zero interest in psychology because, like so many people, I thought it was just about crazy people in therapy. And I knew I didn't want to do that. Uh-huh. So I started off studying biology. I was interested in animals and animal behavior. And I just sort of stumbled into an introductory psychology class. And my eyes were open. They were doing all these cool things, you know, figuring out how the brain works and running rats through mazes. And so I got hooked on that. And really, I became a professor in hindsight because I like being a student so much. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to prolong it as much as I could, and being a professor was the next best thing.
Okay. So all facets of life and education, you know, evolve. How is the field of psychology different than it was when you first started teaching?
Well, in many ways it's the same, but there has certainly been a shift in how research gets done, and it's gotten much more complicated. There are now so many more hoops you have to jump through to get an experiment off the ground or to get research funding. It's more difficult. But they used to make fun of psychology for being the science of college sophomores, because so many of the studies were laboratory experiments using college students, because that's, you know, most of the researchers were at colleges and universities and used the people who you have at hand. And there weren't a lot of people in many of these experiments. You get a couple dozen people together and then you draw these conclusions about human nature. Mm-hmm. And I think that has sort of fallen by the wayside. And studies now tend to be much larger with thousands of people. And there's more of an effort to get a diverse group of people from all economic and racial backgrounds, all age groups. So that's something that's really different.
I'm interested, as a psychologist, are you always analyzing people and what they're doing and saying?
No, that'd be too much work.
Okay.
but you certainly regularly in your day-to-day interactions with people notice, oh, okay, well, that's a perfect example of what I just lectured on in, you know, my class. So yeah. You notice things.
Yeah.
But it's not an effortful, you're not on the spot right now, Jay,
okay.
I promise.
You're not going to go back and enter all this.
Well, I don't do abnormal psychology. Okay. So.
How about, before we get into a few more questions, I'm kind of fascinated on how you're doing all these, and you've done them for years, decades, all the interviews with like news outlets across the country and the world. How did that all kind of come about?
Well, part of it is just because I started doing research on day-to-day topics that everybody's interested in. Gossip, for example, mm-hmm. creepiness, So just by virtue of the fact that I was doing studies on things that your average person finds interesting, started opening the door. But it wasn't really until about 10 years ago when I started doing a lot of popular press writing. Mm-hmm. I started writing for Psychology Today, and I started writing articles for various magazines. I found out that journalists just sit down and do a Google search. I'm looking for an expert on blank. And if you've been writing for these magazines, your name pops up right away and they give you a call.
Yeah.
And then somebody hears you talking to them and then they want to talk to you. So it sort of snowballs. But this was never a goal of mine. I never set out to be somebody who sits in a radio station and does interviews. It just sort of happened. But it's fun. It's a good time.
Okay. Talking today to longtime Knox College professor of psychology, Frank McAndrew. So let's talk a little bit about social media. The whole social media fascinates me. And like I said, it's good and bad, but it seems like a lot of social media is, you have to pick a side, defend it, and then destroy or embarrass the other side you don't agree with. What's your thoughts on the impact of social media on modern social life?
Yeah, as time goes on, I'm starting to get more pessimistic about it. At first, I thought, well, this is great. You know, it's a way to stay in touch with people easily, mm-hmm. Keep track of long-lost friends from high school and college and former students. But when I see the negative turn that it's taken in our political life and day-to-day social life, I don't think that good. I think what's happened is social media, we're not prepared for it psychologically. We still have caveman brains. We're used to living in these little groups of about 150 people, and you knew everybody personally. Mm-hmm. And this world of strangers, so many of them, is a new phenomenon for us. So we take our predisposition to judge other people and try to make who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. And then this gets magnified by social media. And you're suddenly exposed to all kinds of people who agree with you on everything, which makes you feel pretty smart, so that when you do run into people who disagree with you, you feel even more confident. And another real downside of it is, especially for younger people, it's so much easier to feel like a loser in the world of social media. Everybody is attractive. Everybody's having an exciting life. You see it in front of you all the time. And then even though you might be trying to do that yourself, you know mm-hmm. that behind the scenes, you're really this boring person who's not having as much fun as everyone else and isn't as exciting as everyone else. And that kind of makes you feel down. You're, again, back in the day, in your small little tribe, there might have been two or three people in your cohort that you had to keep your eye on as rivals. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, the sky's the limit. There's just so many people. And I think interacting with people over social media removes a lot of the guardrails that we usually have about civil discourse with each other. If you're sitting face to face with somebody having a conversation,
right.
It's much harder to scream at them or insult them or just be mean-spirited. But when it's an anonymous stranger online, all those shackles are gone and you feel free to just vent because it's almost like you're not attacking a real person.
Right. Obviously, some people can stay above the fray and just either use it for the social purposes of getting along, or they just want to get it for knowledge. But like, what causes people to actually engage and actually go after people? Even people there's friendships that are lost.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's an interesting point because you're right. We will defend and pursue a point of view in a vigorous way that we would never do in person.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think, again, it's the face-to-face thing really does keep us in check. You don't want to be a jerk when you're talking to someone. And yes, you can still be a jerk online, but I think it takes you longer to realize you're being a jerk,
yeah.
Especially when you have a bunch of other people in your community commenting on what you're saying, yeah, you tell them.
Uh-huh.
'Cause so you get rewarded for that in a way that you might not in person.
Here's another topic I'm interested in getting your take on is celebrity gossip. I know you've done a lot of, talk and research on this, but, I don't know if there's ever a downtime, but it's been alive and well, with the ongoing friendship, relationship, whatever you want to call it, between Taylor Swift and Kansas City Chiefs star Travis Kelce. But let's start out with that one. Why is the world so consumed with you know, celebrity gossip and them in particular, you know, it's either people can't get enough of it or they can't stand it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me start with them in particular. Okay. I think one of the reasons they're such a sensation, and it's the same way with Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, mm-hmm. they're bringing two different worlds together that usually don't mix that
much. That's a good
point. So you've got the pop singer, music world, and all of their fans suddenly having something in common with the NFL football fans, and they may not ordinarily talk to each other that much, and that multiplies the number of people that are interested tremendously. Same with the royal Prince Harry deal. You've got the people who are fascinated by the royals and the Brits and all that suddenly slamming into Hollywood, and this really multiplies the number of people tremendously. But then backing up, well, why do we care at all about these people that we're not going to know? And, mm-hmm. and the very first time I got interested in gossip, I can still remember standing in line at the grocery store right here in Galesburg, and the line wasn't moving very fast. And I was kind of stalled right by the rack where all the tabloid magazines were. And I'd never really thought about them before or looked at them.
Okay.
But I found myself on that day looking at them and saying, how do they stay in business? How do all of these different magazines make money? Who's reading this stuff? Why do we care? And then I started to do a little research on, well, what do psychologists know about this? Hardly anybody had written anything about it at all. And that got me interested in the whole gossip thing. I think this is another case of modern technology and media hijacking our caveman brains.
Mm-hmm.
In the old days, if you knew a lot about somebody, by definition, that was a socially important person to you. And that meant you had to keep track of them and find out what they were up to because you were going to have to deal with them. Well, in the 21st century, I'm never going to meet Travis Kelce or Taylor Swift, I don't think.
Uh-huh.
They shouldn't matter to me. But the fact that I already know a lot about them kind of tricks my brain into, I want to know a little more about what's going on here. Now, consciously, I know they shouldn't matter, but that impulse is still there. And so you end up knowing a lot about celebrities, more about celebrities than you know about your next door neighbor, probably.
Right. And, you know, being in the media, you know, going, we talked about why people like it, but there's also the opposite end. People just can't stand. They just don't understand. And they get irritated that this getting all this attention. But, you know, one of the things I say, you know, being in the media is like, if people want it, you give it to them. And if, mm-hmm. if they don't want it, then you either turn a channel or don't read it or whatever. But, you know, obviously people are interested in this. So.
Yeah, you're giving the people what they want. And those people who are holier than thou and are being critical of, say, Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce, they have their own celebrities that they're interested in. They're just dismissing these particular people as kind of shallow and beneath them. I don't know who their people of interest may be, but there's somebody that they're interested in.
And there's probably, I was going to say, there's probably some that say they hate it, but deep down inside, they're watching it or reading it just as much as anybody else.
Yeah, a lot of it is impression management. You don't want people to think that you like it. And so you will publicly pretend that you don't. But they serve a very valuable social function, really. They're kind of like friends in law. Mm-hmm. Think of celebrities as people we all know.
Mm-hmm.
You and I don't know each other well, but we could go out and have lunch and talk about Donald Trump and what's going on with his, you know,
right.
Legal issues, or we could talk about Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift. They're like people that we know in common, and that opens the door for us to establish a real relationship with ourselves. So I think of it as kind of a social skill. You know, you're keeping up on things that other people are interested in,
right.
Which gives you a segue into dealing with them.
Is there any one of these celebrity gossip things that's kind of like, you know, an all-time, best, or one that's like shocked you, that's like, why, you know, I'm really surprised that this one has taken off?
I guess I'd be hard pressed to come up with one off the top of my head.
Yeah.
I know I've had that experience frequently where I see something become a sensational story and my first reaction is, well, who cares? But I then realize, well, this just happens to be a celebrity I don't know anything about. It might be a generational thing. I'm an old guy, so maybe this is a young person that young people care about. And I find it hard to understand why people are interested because it's not for me.
Okay.
You know, it's not a story designed for a guy my age.
Okay. We're wrapping up our time with Knox College professor of psychology, Frank McAndrew. How about gossip in general? Take away the celebrity. It's been around forever, gossip, obviously. Why are people so interested to figure out something about somebody else?
Well, it's I think of it as a social skill. Again, it's about keeping up with what other people are doing. And again, if we go back to our prehistoric days, to be socially successful, you had to know what was going on in your group. You had to know who had powerful friends and who didn't. You had to know who was sleeping with whom. Mm-hmm. You had to know the history of the relationship between two people. And if you were totally uninterested in that, if you just didn't care, you didn't do very well. You didn't know what was going on. You would get swindled by people who were untrustworthy, but you didn't know they were untrustworthy because you never took the trouble to find out what they were up to. And those people got weeded out of the population. So we're the descendants of busybodies. Mm-hmm. Our ancestors were the ones who were good at keeping their finger on the pulse of social life in their group and knowing who you could trust and who you couldn't and who was going to be a good ally. They were skillful at hanging on to friends. And the social skill part is about doing it well. Bad gossips are people who use it in a very transparent, selfish way. They badmouth their rivals so they can get ahead, or they're just clueless and they blab sensitive stuff to anybody that will listen when they shouldn't. But people who are good gossips are usually pretty popular. They have a reputation for knowing what's going on, but they also have a reputation for being discreet. And yeah, so I know it gets a bad rap, and I'm sure there are people listening right now who are saying, what kind of person would ever say that gossip is good? Yeah.
As far as one last question here, you've been in the business a long time, and you've delved into a lot of topics, but is there something that you haven't, you know, dug into that you really want to, as far as that kind of topic?
Oh, I'm kind of interested in everything. Uh-huh. So not a week goes by that I don't run into some topic or other that I say, oh, that's cool. I should do something with that. But there's only so many hours in the day. And but nothing in particular. No, okay. No. Uh-huh. Like you said, I've been at it a long time.
Right.
So I've had a chance to do
a lot
of the things that I've wanted to.
You sure have. So that wraps up my conversation with Knox College professor of psychology, Frank McAndrew. Frank, this isn't the Today Show, and I'm not quite Jay Leno, but hopefully this Jay was able to ask a few decent questions about why people act, say, and think like they do. So, Frank, thank you for joining today on Galesburg Live.
Thanks, Jay. It was the best part of my day.
Okay, thank you.